Forge Ministries is pleased to welcome Wesley Strackbein with a message entitled, The War Where No Dragon Flies, An Urgent Call to Battle.
Thank y'all for coming. Just a couple points of background. On the biographical front, my name is Wesley. I'm the oldest of seven children. And my mom and a couple of my sisters you'll see here. I've got two married children, one in Virginia and one in Texas. What did I say? Oh, you're right. I'm not the father. That's another point of misconception that some have, including Mr. Covey here. But we have recently launched a family outreach called Unbroken Faith Ministries. And you can go to our website, unbrokenfaith.org, to learn more about that. And our goal is to encourage families to earnestly contend for the faith once delivered in the saints, as you find in Jude verse 3, and to pass that true faith unbroken from generation to generation. And by the way, we're a work in progress. We're an imperfect family that's still learning and growing and figuring things out by the grace of God. And we need that grace, as each one of you who's here needs that grace. And so we pray for that, even as we seek to stand fast in the faith, which is the message of this week's conference. Anyway, you can check out our website there and more information about some of the projects we have underway. But for lack of, given the time we have, I want to go ahead and delve into my talk. And it's an unusual title. I had a couple people in the hallway ask me if there were going to be dragons in my talk, since that's in the title. And let's just dive in. I'm going to dive in with a quote from literature, from a document called the Finnis Birth Fragment, of which there's only about 50 lines extant from that. It's a story that's incomplete, that's also mentioned some of the characters in Beowulf, who some of you may have heard of or read or seen different renditions of. And it goes like this. This is not dawn from the east. No dragon flies here. The gables of our halls are not burning, but men are making an attack. Sounds pretty poetic and epic, doesn't it? Well, the story, and I'm really going to talk about that story. It's really just the setup for my talk, but essentially there's a Danish prince who is gone and he is wintering in his brother-in-law's hall, Finn's stronghold, hence Finnsburg fragment, and some other party, and we don't know who, we think maybe the Frisians coming to get the Danes, come and attack him. And the story isn't finished. We don't know the whole story, but what we do know is that he sees torches of approaching attackers coming to this winter stronghold. And it's kind of mystical. But the point I want to make to you today, and with the point of this talk, we have so many battles raging. Bradley Pierce talked about the battle in the courts. Of course, he recalibrated our conversation to emphasize the fact that we don't want to bow before the Supreme Court. But it's a battle we all recognize, the battle to end the shedding of innocent blood and abortion. We have a battle that's been raging more recently in the media and in our cities like Houston over transgender. You know, can't even go into a bathroom of your own gender without having to worry about some weirdo. Okay, these are all battles that we talk about, that we recognize, that are in the media. You know, they're talked about on Fox News by Sean Hannity and Kelly, and the other commentators. They're on Rush Limbaugh and so forth. There's a lot of battles to talk about, but I want to talk to you about battles that you probably won't hear about on Fox News, and yet they are critically important battles. In fact, what I'm going to call them are existential threats to our faith. Existential threats to us persevering. What do I mean by existential threat? Well, an existential threat, this is a foreign policy wonks throw this around. They talk about Hitler was an existential threat, the atomic bomb is an existential threat. And I want to give you Phil Walter. He's a member of the Military Writers Guild. He's a former military guy, International Institute of Strategic Studies. He's an associate member of the Foreign Policy Research Institute. He says this. He says, while an existential threat is generally defined as something that is a threat to existence, this is an imprecise and deserves further explanation. A more detailed definition could point to a threat being existential if it involves a group with a capability to permanently change another group's values and the way it governs itself against the latter's will. So some foreign invaded army, that their very existence is threatened by their very way of life and the way they go about things is threatened by this peril, whether it's ISIS. You've probably heard ISIS is an existential threat. Well, one of the guys says, no, they're not an existential threat. They're confined to the Middle East. That's a debate that rages by the politicos that we see in Washington and elsewhere. My definition is going, for the sake of our talk, this is Wesley's definition, is that this, that there's the existence of certain sins in our midst that fundamentally threaten the integrity of our faith. And if left uneradicated, I didn't say unmanaged, I didn't say unchecked, I didn't say unappeased, I said these sin threats that if left uneradicated will destroy our witness and wreck our families. And these existential threats are often not recognized as such and are an awareness or our attempts to minimize these threats does nothing to lessen their severity. These are threats upon our faith and family that must be dealt with. I'm going to give you the five if you're taking notes up front. And you'll all recognize these immediately. The first is lust. The second is peace with the world in a passive toleration of idolatry. The third is the failure of family discipleship. The fourth is pride. And the fifth is discontentment and ingratitude. If you turn on Fox News and hear discussions about lust, or you actually hear about a guy named Newt Gingrich who left one wife, married another, and now he's running for president. You know, we like him, right? Or do we? You know? But these are issues that are core. They're existential threats to our families. And I'm going to take you to a scene, and starting out our discussion, to a royal palace in faraway Jerusalem, and there since a nearly lifeless man in his bedchamber, his body growing colder by the hour. One of the ablest and most renowned rulers the world had ever known, he lay hapless, his once sturdy frame wasting away. Brought to his aid was Abishag the Shunammite, and from her the king drew warmth and comfort. And yet the comfort he received masked a much greater pain that had marked the waning years of his life. As well as all that he had fought for, he saw to be unraveling. Who am I talking about? Who do I speak of? I speak of the great David that took on Goliath of Gath in a field, who knew who he was. He wrote in Psalm 16, "The lions have fallen to me in pleasant places. Yea, I have a goodly heritage." The young man who said that the God has saved me from the paw of the lion and the bear. He will give me victory over this uncircumcised Philistine. Who stands mocking the Lord Jesus Christ? He didn't say God, Daddy, he said Jehovah. Will any man stand up to fight against him? And yet now, he's in this seemingly hapless state. He doesn't even know that his fourth-born son, Adonijah, is leaving yet another rebellion, falling in the wake of Absalom and many other trials and travails. And his wife, Bathsheba, comes into his chamber there, to his bedchamber, and with passionate words, she reminds him that Solomon is the one who is supposed to take the word, and she says these words. I want you to listen to the words of Bathsheba in 1 Kings chapter 1, verses 20. "My Lord, O King, the eyes of all Israel are upon you." What are you going to do, David? You don't even have a clue of what's going on. You've lost touch with reality. You've got some other woman laying next to you to keep you warm. How can this happen? How can this man who fought the dragon, so to speak, who slayed Philistine giants and brought back foreskins that was his bride's price for Saul's daughter, and yet there was a battle he chose not to fight, an existential threat to his faith and to the future of his children. And this is the battle. These are the battles that we must focus on, even as we think about the battles in Washington and Austin and so forth. And what do you think the existential threat is in this one? Well, it's the first one I mentioned, and it's lust. But how did David reach such a pathetic state after so many renowned exploits? And I would suggest to you, in looking from the Scriptures, that that point came long before he was out looking on the balcony and beheld Bathsheba, as we know the story is told. And we actually see this. And I want to take you to, and you can write this in your notes for further contemplation, but 2 Samuel chapter 5, verses 10 through 13. And this is how, after David has become king and he begins to be successful, it says, David went on and he grew great. And the Lord God of hosts was with him. The Hiram king of Tyre sent messengers to David and cedar trees and carpenters and masons, and they built David a house. And David perceived that the Lord God had established him king over Israel, and that he had exalted his kingdom for his people Israel's sake. Well, that sounds great. He's king. God has exalted him. What is the very next verse? And David took to him more concubines and wives out of Jerusalem after he was come from Hebron, and there were yet more sons and daughters born to David. Is there something bother you about this picture? Is there something that he should be considering? Well, actually, there very much is. There very much is something important. That David's act of marrying new wives as Israel's king was a direct violation of God's revealed law. A direct violation. You say, where is that found? Deuteronomy? We look at Moses there in that book of his closing. He says, the king shall not multiply horses to themselves. They shall not multiply horses, for as much as the Lord said unto you, he shall henceforth return no more. Neither shall he multiply wives to himself, lest they turn his heart away. So this is a king who God has made successful. This is a king whom God has prospered. He said that he saw that the Lord had exalted him and he took other wives. He found a measure of success and he compromised. He had an issue of lust in his life. Romans 13:14 says, make not provision for the flesh to fulfill the lust thereof. And an important principle is this, that sin does not stay static. You know, I said earlier in my definition of an existential threat, it has to be eradicated. It can't be managed. Oh, this is something I can deal with on the side. Because sin does not stay static. When left unforsaken and undestroyed, inevitably brings forth bad fruit. Galatians 6:7-8 says, be not deceived, God is not mocked. For whatsoever a man sows, that shall he also reap. For he who sows to his flesh shall of flesh reap corruption, and he who sows to the Spirit shall of the Spirit reap life everlasting. You reap what you sow. And then that brings us to that incident that I talked about a minute ago, 2 Samuel 11:1. It says, it came to pass, after the year was expired, at the time when kings go forth to battle, that David sent Joab and his servants with him and all Israel, and they destroyed the children of Ammon and besieged Rabbah. But David tarried still in Jerusalem. So he was idle. And we know the story of how he takes Bathsheba and he ends up facilitating the killing of Uriah the Hittite. He tries to cover the whole matter up. And he tried to get Uriah to go be with his wife, and that didn't happen. So he had to come up with a little more sinister plot. And so he's facilitating the murder of another man. And Nathan comes to confront him. And I won't go through that entire chapter, but you know the famous phrase, thou art the man. I'm going to read a little bit from 2 Samuel chapter 12, verses 7 and following. Nathan says, thou art the man. Thus says the Lord God of Israel, I anointed you king over Israel, and I delivered you out of the hand of Saul. And I gave thee thy master's house and thy master's wives to thy bosom, and gave thee the house of Israel and Judah. And if that had been too little, I would moreover have given you many such things. Wherefore, and I want you to listen to Nathan's words here very carefully. Wherefore have you despised the commandment of the Lord to do evil in His sight? And you have killed Uriah the Hittite with the sword, and have taken his wife to be your wife, and have slain him with the edge of the sword of the children of Ammon. Now therefore the sword shall never depart from thine house, because you have despised me. Now what do you think? This is a man who's has all of the trappings of a godly man. He's a man after God in heart. Twice already, what has he said? You have despised me. He didn't say it once. He said it twice. And we don't often think, when we have our secret sins or unconfessed things, I don't think we're self-conscious about the fact that we're actually despising God. Here's what we read in Proverbs 14:2. He who walks in his uprightness fears the Lord, but he who is perverse in his ways despises him. Proverbs 13:13. Whosoever despiseth the word will be destroyed, but he who fears the commandment will be rewarded. So we think about this problem, the problem of lust, and I don't need to really elaborate, especially for younger ears here, but it's an epidemic, and if you read the statistics from Barna on down, the lust problem in the church, the pornography, I don't need to really elaborate. I think you men and others know what I'm talking about. This is an existential threat. It brings down kingdoms, brings down ministries, it brings down families. It's destructive, and we can talk about fighting abortion. We can talk about somebody out over there in you know, three houses down that's a homosexual, it's transgender, cross-dressing. You know, that's a battle that needs to be fought, but the most important battle, I fear, for our time is these important threats, and lust is a defining one. And what happens? What is the judgment that's going to be had? Nathan says that, I will raise up evil against thee out of your own house. I will take wives before your own eyes and give them to your neighbor, and he shall lie with the wives in the sight of the sun. For you did it in secret, but I will do this thing before of Israel and before the sun. Now I want you to stop and think for a minute. How many people do you think really knew? We know because we have the historical record. We have God's Word. We can look in 1 Kings 11 and see what happened with Bathsheba. But if you actually carefully study the record, there's no indication that anybody beyond the royal family really knew about it, if you think about it. Have you seen the example? There wasn't a press release sent out. There wasn't, you know, they didn't have the tabloids. I mean, there's some conjecture here, but there's no indication outside the royal family that anyone really knew about what David had done, outside Joab and Nathan and a few others. But there was one man named Ahithophel, who was the chief counselor of David, who happened to be Bathsheba's grandfather. And Ahithophel in the Absalomic rebellion, he's Bathsheba's grandfather. What does he tell Absalom when David leaves the city? Take his concubines, and if you look at the context, you look at the text, it's the same place where he looked over to see Bathsheba, commits this act, lewd body acts, as to throw dirt in his father's face. That family knew what happened, and it wreaked that sin. Made, well, we want to say made, you got to be careful. The children knew about that, and Absalom knew what he was doing. He knew what he was doing. And so his family is going to have this season of strife. So dear friends, we have to take this seriously, this existential threat. And regrettably, Solomon didn't learn this, and he's going to take strange wives. We read this later on in the book of 1 Kings. And I don't have the chapter reference. I apologize for that. But I'm going to read just a couple verses. And I believe this is 1 Kings chapter 11. But King Solomon loved many strange women, together with the daughter of Pharaoh, women of the Moabites, Ammonites, Edomites, Zidonians, and Hittites. And he says he had 700 wives, princes, and 300 concubines. And it says what? His wives turned away his heart. So he ends up setting up monuments to Chemosh and Moab and Molech, all these abominable gods of Ammon and so forth. And what does it say in verse 9? It says the Lord was angry with Solomon. It says he was angry. Does that help you put things in context when you think about lust, that God is angry with you? It says he's angry with Solomon. He's angry. This is not my words. These are the words of God given to us. Because his heart had turned from the Lord of Israel, who had appeared to him twice. What is he saying there? To whom much is given, much is required. I appeared to you twice, Solomon. And now you're doing this? Not acceptable. And what does God say? Wherefore the Lord said to Solomon, forasmuch as this is done of you, and you have not kept the covenant of my statutes, which I have commanded you, I will surely rend the kingdom from you and will give it to thy servant. Now there had been a promise made, if you go back to 1 Samuel chapter 7, when David has the vision, to build the temple, and Nathan, this is another scene with Nathan the prophet, and he goes, and I'm going to paraphrase, he says, if you follow me and all your sons after you, then I will be with you and your God forever. And this is going against that. Now, God is going to still work through the Davidic line. He's still going to bring Jesus Christ. We talked about the Lion of the tribe of Judah in our context of Judah, but there is going to be consequences. Well, what does the Bible say? 1 Corinthians 6:18, it says, flee fornication. 1 Timothy 2:11, 1 Peter 2:11. Dearly beloved, I beseech you as strangers and pilgrims on the earth, abstain from fleshly lusts, which what? Which war against your soul. It may not look like a dragon to you. It may look like a pretty skirt or this or that and the other. But there, you may not call it the dragon, but this is going to destroy you. It's going to destroy your family. It's going to destroy perhaps your church. Absent the grace of God, this is an existential threat. What do we read in Ephesians 5:3? Paul writes to the church of Ephesus. And this is just baffling to me because we just accept this sin. He says, but fornication and uncleanness and covetousness, let it not be once be named upon you, among you, as becometh saints. And I talked yesterday about how do we act becomingly as the children of God. And he's saying this shouldn't ever be named among you. Now, sadly, it's named among us all the time. And we need to get serious about this. In fact, God's so serious about it, in Leviticus 18, 20, verse 30, or 20 through verse 30, he declares that he dispossesses and vomits out and spews out nations. You say, oh, that's for homosexual sin, right? For man lying with man and woman lying with woman. No, it's for the pervasive sin of adultery also. And I suggest that you look at that sometime. The prophet Jeremiah, he spoke of the latter when he proclaimed, this is Jeremiah 5, 8 to 9. He says, they were as fed horses in the morning, and everyone neighed after his neighbor's wife. What's he talking about? Men not being satisfied with the wife that he gave them. What does he say? Shall I not visit him for these things? Says the Lord, and shall not my soul be avenged on such a nation as this? Well, this is the Avenger. This is not the Avenger comic book, television, or movie. This is the Avenger with a capital A who resides in the heaven of heavens. And he said, I will be avenged on a nation of adulterers. And sadly, we have adultery in the church almost as common as in is if you look at the statistics, and we need to take this seriously. And so that's all I'll say about that. Let's move to existential threat number two. Peace with the world and a passive toleration of idolatry. Well, we're going to go to another scene. This one's in the book of Genesis, chapter 31. It's the story of Jacob. Jacob has a very interesting history, which we won't get into in all its gory details, actually interesting details. But you know, after he gets the blessing from Esau, he goes to Laban, and there he is in the land of Haran for 20 years. He ends up marrying Leah and Rachel. He serves them for those for 14 years, and 6 years he served Laban, and then he ends up leaving to go back to his native land. And his father-in-law Laban, who's a rather cantankerous and unhappy father-in-law, chases him down. He chases down Jacob, and they have this confrontation. And not only says, have you taken my grandchildren away from me? Why couldn't we have parted with song and dance and much revelry? But you've also, what does he also say happened? What's his beef with Jacob, other than the fact that he took his grandchildren away? He says, you've taken my gods. Taken my gods? What does Jacob say in response to Laban? He says this in verse 32 of chapter 31. Jacob says, for whomsoever you find your gods, let him not live. Because our brethren discern that thou, what is thine with me, take it of to thee. And then we look at this last part of the sentence. For Jacob knew not that Rachel had stolen them. So we find Jacob, the grandson of Abraham, the son of Isaac, with a wife who is taken at least to some extent up in idolatry. Now we move forward after he sees Esau. And he moves to Succoth on the other side of Jordan and then crosses back to Canaan. And he takes up residence in Shechem. I'm going to read you chapter 33, verse 18. And Jacob came to Salem, a city of Shechem, which is in the land of Canaan, when he came from Paddan Aram. And he pitched his tent, before the city. And there he's going to make an altar. Well, what does that word Salem mean? It probably sounds familiar to me. It means peace. But Henry Morris notes that it should not be considered a proper name here. What it really is translated, Morris writes, is that Jacob came in peace to the city of Shechem. In fact, that's how the English Revised Version reads it, as translated, that Jacob came in peace to the city of Shechem. Thus, not regarding Shalem or Salem as a proper name of a town at all. So he came in peace. Now, they were to live among the Canaanites. That was what God had called. They were to be sojourners in a strange land until God was going to give it to them. But what that suggests is that Jacob had extended an olive branch to the Shechemites. And I'm reminded of the words of Dean Acheson. And by the way, I'm not necessarily a fan of his foreign policy, but when he was Secretary of State under Harry Truman, he said something that's, I think, quite instructive. He said, "No people in history have ever survived who thought they could protect their freedom by making themselves inoffensive to their enemies." You don't make friends with the enemy and expect to protect your freedom. You don't make peace with the Shechemites and expect to have things to go well. In the very next verse, or the very next chapter, what happens? His daughter Dinah goes out with the children of the land and is defiled. He's defiled. And I want to read to you, the actual words of this verse. I may have passed over it too quickly, perhaps. What does it say? It says he came to Salem, a city of Shechem, in the land of Canaan, and it says he pitched his tent before the city. Does that sound familiar? Does that sound like familiar to another character who pitched his tent towards Sodom? Remember that? But we skip over this one because Sodom was destroyed, right? Shechem wasn't destroyed, so we tend to skip over that. And the words there are actually more damning than those of Lot's, because if you look at the Hebrew, before the face of the city means in the presence of, in front of. It's not just towards Sodom, it's right in front of Shechem in this case. And as I said, his daughter. And then we find a chapter 34 of Dinah. And what's interesting about this chapter is nowhere God is invoked in this chapter. It's like they forgot to reference God in deliberating with Shechem's father as to what's to be coming to the circumstance. And his father comes and says, "If we marry our children to you, we got to work something out. My son likes your daughter. You know, maybe he shouldn't have done what he did, but let's make a deal. Let's make a bargain. And, you know, your sons can marry our daughters and so forth." And then Simeon and Levi come to the fore and say, "Well, as long as they're circumcised, then we can make a deal." Who's the absent voice in the chapter? Who says nothing? His name is Jacob. He's the head of the family. He's the father of 12 children. And he's an absentee, passive father. He stands idly by as his sons Simeon and Levi strike a deal. Well, what ends up happening, I think you know the story, is they end up going in with their swords and cleaning up house and killing all these men. It was actually a ruse, and it was ungodly. They lied. They bore false witness as to their real intentions. But what is Jacob? How does he respond? His response was, "Oh, I really blew it, guys. I should have been taking responsibility. We moved before an ungodly pagan city." No, it's all about me. He says this to Simeon and Levi: "You have troubled me to make me stink among the inhabitants of the land." He's thinking about his own personal hide, his own personal reputation. He says, "And I being few in number, they shall gather themselves together against me and slay me, and I shall be destroyed." He's only thinking about his own skin. He's not thinking about his duty and responsibilities to put his family in a place where they're protected and to take responsibility. And he's countenancing idolatry and other things. Well, the very next verse, the very next chapter, God intervenes and says to Jacob, "Arise, go to Bethel and dwell there, and make there an altar to God who appeared unto thee when you fled from the face of Esau your brother." Then Jacob said to his household. Now Jacob turns a corner here, which is great. And all that are within him, what does he say to them? He speaks in a declarative sense. "Put away the strange gods that are among you." Do you think he just found out there were strange gods? Now, it says he didn't know Rachel had one, but he knew they had them. And he hadn't been talking about that. Idols had been in their midst. "Put out the strange gods from among you and clean, and make yourself clean and change your garments. And let us arise and go to Bethel. And I will make an altar unto God who answered me in the day of my distress and was with me in the way which I went." God's back in the picture again. God's center stage. God's center. He's not thinking about his own hide. He's thinking about God and his responsibilities. His conscience is pricked. And he realizes this fundamental and systemic problem within his family must be dealt with. The idols have to be, and he buries them underneath, have to be dealt with. There he buries them out beneath the oak of Shechem. He takes them and does away with them. And I want to talk about a few lessons about passivity and also fatherhood here. Number one, where we live matters. And I'm not suggesting you can't live in a big city, but we need to think about where we locate our families and who we worship with, and not making peace with the enemy. And number two, it's not important enough just to relocate to some and be a part of a covenant-keeping church, but we have to take leadership in our families. If you're not leading your family at home, if you're not demanding that your family abide by God's laws and put away their idols, you're being woefully negligent as a father. So this is a systemic threat. Just like lust is a systemic threat, existential threat, excuse me, it's also systemic too. It goes to the heart of things. That if these things are not dealt with, if we allow idol worship to fester, if we allow unresolved issues, they're going to cause problems. I like what John Calvin says. He says, Jacob confesses his own negligence in having admitted to his house that he had idols, against which the door had been closed by God. Wherever the knowledge of the true God shines, it is necessary to drive far away whatever men fabricate to themselves, which is contrary to the true knowledge of him. Whereas Jacob had been lulled to sleep, either by the blandishments of his wife, or had neglected to do his duty through the carelessness of his flesh, it is now aroused by the fear of danger to become earnest in the pure worship of God. And if this happened, Calvin writes, to the holy patriarch, how much more ought carnal security to be dreaded among us in this season of prosperity? Now, I don't know what's happening in Geneva when he wrote that, but if it can happen to him, it can happen to you. It's what Paul says in 1 Corinthians, I would not that you be ignorant what happened to the children of Israel as they had idols in the desert and they murmured against God. Any man who stands, take heed lest he fall. That's what Calvin said. If it happened to Jacob, it can happen to you. So fathers, and in case of single mothers, must admit negligence where we've fallen short. We must take stock and inventory of our family spiritual state. We must demand the idols where they exist. And we must embrace a God-centered worship and viewpoint in all that we do. If we have to return to Bethel, put it on an altar and say, we serve the one true God, and this is not how Christians should operate. You know, we live set-apart lives. Lust isn't acceptable. Idols aren't acceptable. We're not letting these existential threats destroy us. And show your father taking the lead by having a vision for reformation. That was a vision for reformation. We're leaving this place. We're going somewhere new. You know, what was Bethel? What was the significance of Bethel? Do you remember the story? It was called Luz, and the name was changed. That's where God had appeared to him in a vision with angels coming down. That's the place where his first love, you might say, his first inspiration. Sometimes we need to go back to the simple things, to first principles. And that's what Jacob does. Don't soft pedal your family idols. Get rid of them completely. Bury them. Existential threat number three. And this is closely related, but I want to give some nuance to this. It's related to what I talked about. We just talked about peace with the world and a passive toleration of idolatry. But I want to talk about the failure of family discipleship. And we're going to look at another scene. We've already referenced him. But Lot, who was the nephew of Abraham, you know, when Abraham left Ur of the Chaldees, he brought his nephew Lot along with him. And he was the son of Nahor. And you know the story about how there was a conflict between their herdsmen. I read an old book that I talked about for you, those who, history buffs and guys like Don Hart who run cattle. And I've posed this question at the Faith and Freedom Tour. Don will know the answer, but what was the first cattle range war in history? Well, it took place between Lot and Abraham's herdsmen. That was the first range war. You know, they might not have barbed wire fence back then, but they had a bona fide range war, and they had to get together and work out the details. And that's when Lot is going to look towards Sodom and pitch his tent there, toward the cities of the plain. And the next thing you know, that was in chapter 13, we actually see that Abraham is dwelling in Sodom, and there's a confederation that's going to take him captive and so forth. And then we're going to wind up there in the city after that Abraham comes to his rescue along with his confederates. And that's another great story in itself. But Lot ends up right smack dab in Sodom. But God looks upon this. He sends what's a pre-incarnate Jesus Christ, I believe, down with two angels. And they go and they're going to tell Abraham about this. And you may remember the story in there debating. And of course, this is just an accommodation. I don't think there's really God debates with people, but exactly. But in the context of the passage, there's a discussion about whether they should let Abraham know about this, what's going to happen to Sodom and Gomorrah. And Genesis 18:19 is very instructive. And he says, well, for I know him, Abraham, that he will command his children, his household after him, that they should keep the way of the Lord to do justice and judgment, that the Lord may bring upon Abraham that which he spoke of him. So we know that Abraham was discipling his children. But then in the very next chapter, chapter 19, there came two angels to Sodom and Eben. And what does it say there? And I want you to really take note of this. And Lot sat in the gate of Sodom. And Lot, seeing them, arose to meet them, and he bowed himself with his face toward the ground. Now, we know there's a lot of bad things to say about Lot, but the New Testament gives us insight as to his faith. We read in 2 Peter 2, 7-8, it says that, and just Lot was delivered, vexing with filthy conversation of the wicked, for that righteous man dwelling among them, and seeing and hearing, he vexed his righteous soul from day to day due to their unlawful deeds. J.C. Ryle notes, I think rightly, he says, Lot was a true believer. He was a real child of God, a justified soul, a righteous man. So we can take pot shots at Lot, but we need to think about us. Think about our families. You know, we can be regenerate and make mistakes. We can be of the redeemed and get off the course. And that's what I believe we see with Lot. And Lot's effort to lead, and here's a proposition. I'm going to state this carefully. I wrote this out because I want to be precise. Lot's effort to lead in the gates of Sodom. Now, what were the gates before I give you the definition? Do you know what the gates are? The gates is the place where the judges go. The gates are the place where Wesley Thomas is going where the matters of state, where the laws of the land, where cases are decided. It's where the jurisprudence is given, where, you know, Blackstone's common law, it's where the judges sit. And see, he's seeking to have an influence there. But here's what I would suggest to you. That's Lot's effort to lead in the gates of Sodom was built on an anemic and profound distortion of God's program. For our cultural change in the gates of a nation or a city-state is to be rightly pursued. And I want you to think about this, because what's the promise that God gave to Abraham? We need to step back a little bit and get some context. What does he say to Abraham in giving his promise? He says, Genesis chapter 22. Now, this is later, but it's found several places in Genesis. In blessing, I will bless thee, and in multiplying thee, I will multiply thee, as the stars of the heaven and the sand upon the seashore, and thy seed shall possess the gates of thine enemies. He's talking prophetically about your children are going to possess the gates of the enemy. Well, Lot's trying to do a good deed, isn't he? He's in the gates. So is he carrying out the promise to Abraham? We read the same thing or similar words in Genesis 24:60 of Rebekah as she marries Isaac. Thou art our sister. This is Laban and his extended family speaking. Be thou the mother of thousands of millions, and let thy seed possess the gates of those who hate them. Well, here's what I would suggest to you. That faithful, and this is not just my suggestion, it's actually in the scriptures, but I would ask that you listen to this and consider it. Faithful family discipleship is the key to keeping and holding the gates of a nation. And that faithful family discipleship is predicated on teaching our children God's standards and not syncretizing with the enemy. Where do we see this in the scriptures? We actually see it in this beautiful song that David wrote for his son Solomon. He wrote his to his son Solomon. I don't have the beginning. He says it's vain for you to rise up late and eat the bread of sorrows, for God gives his beloved sleep. He's actually wrote that psalm just before Solomon takes the throne, who is a very young man. You don't need to be fretting Solomon about how you're going to lead the kingdom. Don't stay up late. You know, get your sleep. But he gives a powerful vignette into this point I'm making. He says, lo, children are an heritage of the Lord. The fruit of the womb is his reward. As arrows are in the hands of a mighty man, so are the children of your youth. Happy is that man who has his quiver full of them. They shall not be ashamed, but shall speak with the enemies in the gates. That's the program God has, discipling your children so they can stand in the evil day. Not accommodation, not sending your daughters out like Dinah to be with the children of the land, not just trying to leave your family to whatever and going out, I'm just going to go to Austin and be part of abolishing abortion, but I'm not giving one whim or wit about my children. Think about Moses' final address that he gave. He gives 4 weeks of discourses approximately After that 40-year sojourn in the wilderness, there he is reiterating the law that was in Exodus 20 and Deuteronomy 5. He's telling about what went wrong with the spies, and he's giving his last series of counsel and discourses. And he closes that out by saying this, among the very last words of Moses. And he says this in Deuteronomy 32, 46, and 47. He says, "Set your hearts unto all the words which I testify among you this day." That what? That you should take the spear to the children of Canaan and kill them. No, that's not what he says. "That you shall command your children to observe, to do these things, all the words of this law. For it is not a vain thing for you, it is your life. And through this," listen to these words, "through this thing shall you prolong your days in the land of Jordan which you go to possess." Not through having the largest army and the most F-16 fighters and the greatest, we have water running beneath our city like Hezekiah and we're ready. You're not going to prolong your days in Jordan where you go to possess it by being clever military tacticianers. You're going to prolong your days in the land where you go to possess because you've taught your children. That's the key. Do you see the point I'm making? It's family discipleship, ultimately, is going to see success in the gates long term. Now, there may be short term victories, but we have to measure this in terms of how God measured it. And what do we find in Judges 2 after Joshua's time? What do we learn? This sad story in the book of Judges. It says, "There arose a generation who knew not the Lord, nor yet the works he had done for Israel." How is it possible to not know that God parted the Red Sea? How is it possible not to know of how God led them? It says they didn't know the works he had done for Israel. How is it possible two generations later not to know the story of your fathers? Not to know the great... And somehow they didn't know. It says they didn't know the works he had done for their fathers, and they did evil in the sight of the Lord, and they served Balaam, and they forsook the God of their fathers, and sought Ashtaroth. And here we have that word again. "And the anger of the Lord was hot against Israel, and he delivered them into the hands of the spoilers who spoiled them, and they sold them into the hands of the enemies round about them, so that they could not any longer stand before their enemies." They're not even in the gates. They're not even allowed at the gates. They're in shackles and chains, and we learn that they don't even have access to weapons. They're having to hide out in wine presses like Gideon, and they can't even find each other. So much for standing in the gates of the nation. Game over. Game over. Why? Because they did not teach their children the things of the Lord. It's not a vain thing for you. It's your life. And through doing that, you're going to prolong your days. So is this an existential threat? Now that you say, well, this is an act of omission. It's not an act of commission. We don't train our children, but God's Word makes it clear, if we don't train them, then we're going to be slaves. Slaves to a foreign invader. Here's the principle. You can conquer the entire land of Canaan. You can get troops and take Washington, throw out Obama. By the way, I'm not suggesting insurrection for the tape here. I'm just saying, I'm just taking the hypothetical, but you can do whatever it happens to be, du jour, you know, you can do all these things, but if you neglect to treat your children and family in the process, and eventually your family will fail, and eventually the nation will be lost, apart from God's intervening grace. Do you see that? Put another way, when faithful family discipleship ceases, the gates of a nation will be compromised, perverted, and if no remedy is made, the gates will be lost to the enemy. And it happens over again. It happens in the time of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, or ungodly young men. Wait a minute. He's a preacher. He's a priest. There are a lot of pastors. A lot of people involved in ministry even. And that sounds good, right? They're doing the work of the Lord. But they're not restraining their children. And what happens is God, through this little boy Samuel, pronounces a curse. Ichabod and the Ark of the Covenant is taken to the Philistines. He didn't train his children, and Philistia takes over. It happens even Samuel to some extent as his sons go aside for filthy lucre. It happens in the guy we just talked about, the great David, who writes David's final words, 2 Samuel 23, and we see about his failures of discipleship even. It says, "The God of Israel said, the Rock of Israel spoke to me. He who rules over men must be just, ruling in the fear of God, and he shall be as the light of the morning when the sun rises, even a morning without clouds, as the tender grass springing out of the earth by clear shining after the rain. This sounds like a beautiful picture of that will be just, dwelling in the fear of God. But what does he say next? Although my house be not so with God. This is my picture right now. It's not what you see in my family. Now we know Solomon's going to come along and God's going to raise him up. But he said, yet he has made an everlasting covenant, ordered in all things sure. And that covenant's going to stand. And so failures of discipleship lead to challenge and ultimately slavery. We need to take this seriously. Threat. Another proposition I would submit to you in light of this theme is this. And this goes back to the dragon picture we talked about at the beginning, the finished work fragment. The enemy's ungodly worldview is far more dangerous to the health of a nation than the enemy's sword. I repeat that again. The enemy's worldview is far more dangerous to the health of a family and a nation than the enemy's sword. David actually says this. He says this in Psalm 144. He says, blessed be the Lord, God, my strength, who teaches my hands to war and my fingers to fight, my goodness, my fortress, my high tower, my deliverer. It's he who gives salvation to kings, who delivers David, his servant, from the hurtful sword. And what does he say then? What's his focus? He's over the sword. He says, rid me and deliver me from the hand of strange children. Does he say, who have a mighty spear? No. He says, whose mouth speaks vanity, and their right hand is a right hand of falsehood. The enemy who will destroy me because of what they believe and from what they teach. So that what? You know this beautiful passage. That our sons may be as plants grown in their youth. That our daughters may be as cornerstones polished after the similitude of a palace. That our garners may be full, affording all manner of store. That our sheep may bring forth thousands in the stalls. That our oxen may be strong in labor. So forth and so on. Happy is that people, where this is such a case, happy is that people whose God is the Lord. Happy is that people who have broken free from the shackles of the wrong ideas of the enemy, who have been taught toward that end. You know, we might have ISIS in Orlando. We might have ISIS in San Bernardino. That's a problem. But far more serious is the ideas that we must confront in discipling our children. And so that, again, is an existential threat. Well, let's move forward here. Lot's efforts to effect change in Sodom were ultimately futile because he had lost his family's hearts. Lot's failures as a husband and father, not having the hearts of his family, led to the ultimate destruction of Sodom. And you've heard the math given before. I'm not the first speaker or expositor to bring this out. He talks about how he's had sons. He talks about he had sons-in-law and daughters. And if you add them all together, his wife's sons equals 2. Daughters equal to, married daughters is 4. It actually adds up to 10. So if there were 10 faithful in his family, Sodom would have been spared. So you see how discipleship affects the state of a nation? Directly so. 10 faithful. I think Abraham probably knew there were 10. He whittled God down in that very interesting back and forth. So the city-state is destroyed there. Lot placed financial and cultural position ahead of the integrity of his family, and rather than protect his family's heart, he assimilated into an ungodly culture and then sought to change it from the top down. And Bradley talked about this, from the top down rather than from the bottom up. Well, I think there's enough said there. I could go on and on, but I think you get the point that we have to have as our first priority as parents to discharge our duty of training our children and our progeny, having their hearts toward God. And that way we'll see long-term and godly rulership in the gates of the land. So that's just a simple idea, but it's very, very important. Existential threat number 4, and we're going to move quickly for the sake of time. It's a big one. It's defining. It's called pride. They don't talk about that on Sean Hannity's show, right? They don't talk about that in the Wall Street Journal editorial page that so many guys read and as they look at their stocks and on the internet each morning, but it's a big problem, dear friends. Romans 12:3, for I say through the grace given to me to every man that is among you, not to think more highly of himself than he ought, but to think soberly, according as God has dealt to every man the measure of faith. Definition of pride, here's one definition, to think more highly of themselves than you ought in relation to God and your neighbor. And I would say, submit this couple of ideas, couple of propositions. First, pride is driven by self-love rather than a due love of God and our neighbor. Pride involves the breaking of at least 2 commandments, to love God with all your heart and your neighbor as yourself. It leads men to believe that they are wiser than God, And we could spend hours talking about each one of these. I'm just going to give you some propositions. It leads men to prioritize, and this is important, it leads men to prioritize their prerogatives above what God requires of them. Isn't that the story right there in Genesis 3? You said this is what we're supposed to do, God, but we're wiser than you because this serpent says we're going to do our own thing. That's what led Satan to be cast out of heaven with his angels. That's ultimately pride. A due consideration of who we are as creatures before a holy and almighty God is the first step to quell pride and to prompt true humility. I love what Thomas Watson says very beautifully and powerfully. The great, most quoted, perhaps, of all the Puritans. He said, all a man's gifts, and I want you to think about this, all a man's gifts, his pregnancy of parts, his ripeness of wit, are borrowed from heaven. And what wise man will be proud of a jewel that was lent him? If you have an intellect, if you have a gift, where did you get that from? Who made man's mouth? That's what God said to Moses in a different context. Who made the blind to see? God gave you those giftings and those opportunities. I love this, the way he wraps it up. The moon has no cause to be conceited of her light for which she is beholden to the sun. That moon just reflects light it gets from the sun. All that we have, imago Dei, made in the image of God, in him we live and move and have our very being. That's God. We're just going to fall dead without God sustaining sovereignty and providence. We're not going anywhere, you know. Yeah, God holds things up. Why should we think more highly of himself? But I want to point back to the root of it. I said it's basically setting ourselves up in God. Remember how we said God was angry? He was angry with Solomon. He was angry. Here's what Proverbs 16:5 says about pride. Everyone who is of a proud heart is an abomination to the Lord. Those are some strong words. Everyone who is of a proud heart. Have I been prideful? I have, many times. That's an abomination. I better ask forgiveness and fall on my face. Here's what Matthew Henry says. The pride of sinners sets God against them. He that being high in estate is proud in heart, whose spirit is elevated with his condition, so that he becomes insolent in his conduct toward God and man. Let him know that though he admires himself and others caress him and speak flattering words, he is abomination to the Lord God. The great God despises him. The holy God detests him. That's what Matthew Henry says. Well, prideful men will come to shame. And haven't we seen this? And I don't need to add any elaboration. When pride comes, then comes shame. When pride comes, then comes shame. But with the lowly is wisdom. Prideful men will be brought low and abased by God. 2 Samuel 22:28, thine eyes are upon the haughty, that thou may bring them down. That's what God says. My eyes are on the haughty, that I will bring them down. Proverbs 16:18, pride comes before destruction, a haughty spirit before a fall. Proverbs 18:12, before destruction of heart of man is haughty, and before honor is humility. Proverbs 15:25, the Lord will destroy the house of the proud. Do you think that's serious? Do you think that's an existential threat? You see it? He's going to destroy you. He's going to bring you down. It's an abomination. Okay, so Obamacare is still in the books. That's a good fight to fight. But if we don't deal with this pride problem, not a good chapter coming forward for us. Not a good next chapter. Not a good next chapter. And I want to, we're closing, we're wrapping things up here. I've got about, I think, 15 more minutes. But I want to take you to one other scene that's really powerful. And I've told this is one of these things I think about all the time. You know the story of Nebuchadnezzar, how he went and took Jerusalem and ultimately took out the temple in 586 B.C. And Daniel and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego come. And there's lots of great stories of courage. But the theme of that book, and you see it reiterated, I think, 4 or 5 times in that book of Daniel, is this, that the Most High rules in the kingdom of men and he gives it to whomsoever he will. The Most High rules in the kingdom of men and he gives it to whomsoever he will. The Most High rules. Nebuchadnezzar was mighty. He didn't bring himself to that. God raised him up, okay? But Nebuchadnezzar is haughty. And what happens to him? You know the story. He has to eat grass for 7 years, right? And what are the final words he says as he comes to his senses, as he acknowledges the sovereignty of God? And I don't have all the verses written down. He says that you're great in the armies of heaven and no one can say to you, what doest thou? You are the great God. But the last verse of chapter 4 He says, "And I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and extol and honor the King of heaven, all whose works are truth and whose ways are judgment." And what's the last phrase? "And those who walk in pride, he is able to abase." Isn't that what happened? Those who walk in pride, who thought they were the mightiest empire builder, greater than Hannibal, greater than Nimrod, me, Nebuchadnezzar, bow before my image, down, eating grass. Those who walk in pride, he is able to abase. Very next verse, very next chapter, what is the scene? His grandson, Belshazzar. And what does he do? We don't know this from the biblical account, but Cyrus the Great, the Persian general, is out there. He surrounded the cities. And Herodotus says the cities were 375 feet tall. Some people said they were 250 feet tall. There's debates. But they were tall, tall walls. An impregnable force, right? Not unless you're sly, witty Cyrus. And I'll tell that part of the story in just a minute. And so what does he do? He takes those goblets that had been ransacked from the Jerusalem temple and says, "Let's have a night of revelry, guys. We're to, you know," he didn't say it that way exactly, but he invites all the nobles and the princes together, and here they are with those Jerusalem goblets from the temple, and they're whining and dining, and all of a sudden this mysterious hand appears on the wall, and it makes this inscription, and those soothsayers and astrologers, they don't know what it means, and so they call old Daniel, mothballed off somewhere, old Daniel who's been around forever. Gotta figure out someone who can tell us what's going on. And they call him in there, and what does Daniel do? And this is very important. This is really, really important. What's his apologetic methodology? He rehearses everything I just told you about Nebuchadnezzar. He says, "He did this, he did that, and he ate grass, da da da." So what's he doing this? And what does he say in verse 22? "And you, his son," actual grandson, "but you, his son, O Belshazzar, you have not humbled your heart, even though you knew all of this." This is God's word. You knew all of this. You saw someone raise them up in pride, and you did it anyway. Well, brothers and sisters, we have seen men raise themselves up in pride, and we've seen them fall. Many, far too many. Please let's learn the lessons. Please. Let's don't be a Belshazzar after a Nebuchadnezzar. Let's not do it. We know the story. It's the very next chapter. Time had elapsed. But God's wanting to emphasize a point here, right? Right in the wakes of that, another kingdom falls. And Cyrus the Great, they divert the river, they march underneath. And what did that inscription mean? Mene tekel upsarim. Mene, God has numbered your kingdom and finished it. Tekel, you are weighed in the balances and found wanting. Perez, thy kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and the Persians. Game over. Done. Read your history books. That's the end of the Babylonian Empire. It's the Medo-Persians. It's Darius the Great. It's Xerxes. It's all these other characters, the cast of characters that it's Esther and Xerxes and so forth. The Babylonians are history. And right now, go over there to Iraq and go try to find Babylon, the Hanging Gardens. You go outside of Baghdad. I think it's about 20 miles. You won't find anything. Desert sand. Nothing. And Babylon's a byword. It's a byword. And that's what happens to men and kingdoms and families who set themselves up. They become bywords. God resists the proud and he gives grace. And here's the great part about it though. He resists the proud, but what? He gives grace to the humble. "To this man will I look, even to him who is a poor and of a contrite heart and who trembles at my word." Isaiah 66:2. 1 Peter 5. "Be clothed with humility, for God resists the proud and gives grace to the humble. Humble yourselves, therefore, under the mighty hand of God. He may exalt you in due time." That's the answer. If you have pride, don't have pride. Be humble. Be humble. We have about 8 minutes. The last existential threat I want to talk about really briefly. And it's related in some ways, but it's all I want to offer some distinguishment for the sake of our discussion, which I think is helpful. And it's this. It's discontentment and ingratitude. You won't find that in the news either. In fact, all you hear is a lot of complaining about the state of affairs. I think we spend too much time complaining about our nation. We don't look in our hearts and look at what we're supposed to be doing, don't we? Don't we really? Oh, if it, you know, look what happened now. Look what happened now. Well, I talked about nobility yesterday and what it means to be noble and act in a way befitting our station. And there was a young man whose name I've already invoked. His name was Absalom. And there was this slutty, subtle, sly, clever guy named Jonadab who comes to him, and he says this powerful, manipulative but powerful statement, which we should all consider. What does he say to Absalom? Why are you, being the king's son, so lean from day to day? You're lean. You're the son of David. And there's something wrong. We're the king's son. We're the children of the king. And so oftentimes we're like Absalom. We're discontent. We're unhappy about our circumstances. Now, I won't tell you all the story of Absalom, but this is the story of us too oftentimes. We don't have enough recognition. We don't have enough money in the bank. We don't have enough this. And we are not grateful. Well, contentment, I'm going to read you a couple definitions and then we're going to close here. I want to read you about contentment and discontentment. These are some things I've written out. Contentment is rooted in steadfast and unshakable trust in God's sovereignty. It flows from a humble and grateful recognition that God knows what's best for our lives. That's really what it means. God knows what's best for our lives. And that He will most assuredly bring His plan for us to pass in the time and way which is perfect. Is that our way? Is that our time? Moses do? We learn this in the book of Acts. It says that he rose up and he killed this Egyptian taskmaster, but he thought that they would recognize that he was going to be the Redeemer. Well, that wasn't the way. It's bad to be under subjection, but there are ways we have to go about things, and discontentment leads to that. Contentment flows from a cheerful heart of submission to God's law. I want you to listen to this carefully. Contentment flows from a cheerful heart of submission to God's laws, assuming they are wholly just. Do you ever think that God's laws were unjust? A cheerful heart of submission to His created order, recognizing that how He made and ordered all things is His sole and rightful prerogative. A cheerful heart of submission to His providence, acknowledging that how He governs the affairs of men is done for the good of those He loves, in accordance to His unchanging and perfect purpose, which is ordained before the foundations of the world. To be content is to be at peace with God's plan for us. It is to joyfully to accept, number one, how He created us, big nose, small nose, big hair, small hair, whatever. Whose family He made us a part of. You know, there's no perfect father or mother in this room. Are you content with the parents that God's given you? You want to, you know, play swap wives or swap parents? Bad idea. To be content with the parents God gave us. What nation and cultural context He has placed you in. It is to peacefully embrace His good pleasure, and where He has us now as well as where He will take us in the future. To be content, conversely, is to second guess God's plan for us. It is to consider His purpose and ways to be misguided, unfulfilling, and inadequate, and deem His timing in bringing certain realities to pass to be amiss. That's what discontentment is. This is something I wrote up, but doesn't that speak to it? Often we want to question God's timing, we want to question God's program, and even His pride, and either one of these vices in different ways, even His pride, all sin flows from pride, all sin in another way flows from a heart of discontentment, because it is born and fueled by a sentiment that God's decrees, laws, and providence are in some way inadequate for our self-satisfaction, which leads us to set aside His commands to feed our sinful lusts. So in some senses, and there's different observers that say pride is at the head of all sin. You could also say discontentment. They're almost like brother and sister. And that's what leads us astray. Thomas Watson says this, a discontented Christian repines in the midst of mercies as Adam who sinned in the midst of paradise. You couldn't have had it any better than Adam, right? Eve was perfect. The garden was perfect. The trees were perfect. Everything that was good that God, the Lord, created, but somehow it wasn't good enough. It wasn't good enough. And that's what we say to God when we're discontent. God, it's not good enough. It's not good enough. Well, let me suggest to you that this is an existential threat that will destroy us if we don't deal with it. Contentment, Jeremiah Burroughs says, is not only that we forbear from discontented and murmuring expressions, with perverse words against God and others, it's an inward submission of the heart. Not only must the tongue hold its peace, but the soul must be silent. So it's not that we act and we in the outside we comport ourselves in the right way. We need to have our hearts content. And we know that's something we have to learn. It does take time. Paul acknowledged that. What did he say in Philippians? He says, "For I have learned." He didn't say he knew it. He didn't say he was born with it, but we need to strive toward this. "I have learned in whatsoever state I am to be content. I know how to abound, be abased. Everywhere in all things I'm instructed." He's instructed. He learned. I talked about Judah having character growth. He learned those things. "I'm instructed to be full and to be hungry, to bound and to suffer need. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me." A lot more I could say about that subject. I'm just going to make one quick reference that we know. Just as these other things anger God, when we murmur and are discontent, it leads to judgment. And I'm saying a lot of hard things today, but folks, I think we need to hear these words. Because what does he say in Numbers 14? He says, "You've tempted me." This murmuring group of malcontents in that desert, never satisfied. "We want the leeks and the garlic. Wait a minute, he gave you a law. He killed the Egyptians in the Red Sea. He's giving you manna. He's giving you quail." And that they murmur and murmur and murmur and murmur and murmur 10 times, it says. He says, God says, 10 times you have tried me. "How long will I bear with you, this evil congregation who murmurs against me? I have heard the murmurings of the children of Israel, how they murmur against me. And I say to them, as truly as I live." Now, Christ is from eternal past to eternal. "As true as I live." God says, "As true as I'm God, as true as I'm alive in these heavens." He says that your carcasses will fall in the wilderness, and all that are numbered of among you, according to your whole number, from 20 years old and upward, which have murmured against me, will fall, save Caleb the son of Jephunneh and Joshua the son of Nun. Why? Because they were discontent. They weren't happy with the quail. They weren't happy with God's law on Sinai. They weren't happy with their circumstances. Korah rises up and says, "I'm not the chief dog with Moses," and earth opens up, swallows him up. You know, didn't have a fair shake in the Levitical order. That's what happened to him, and every single one of them died. We read in 1 Corinthians 10:10, "Murmur, neither murmur ye as they murmured, and were destroyed of the destroyer." Discontentment, like pride, leads us to seek our own way rather than God's. We must rid ourselves of this existential threat or face serious judgment. Okay, I think I'm out of time, but I'm just going to wrap up. How do we find contentment? Two simple ideas, and there's whole messages that can be given on this, and we don't have time for that, but we fear God, number one. The fear of the Lord, by the fear of the Lord, what men depart from evil. That's what it says in the book of Proverbs. By fear of the Lord is riches, honor, and life. We read that in the Proverbs as well. So the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom and knowledge. The fear of the Lord is the whole duty of man, Solomon says in Ecclesiastes. And when people fear God, they live a certain way. I want to read you one quote on that point. If I can find it here in my notes. Here it is, John Gill. "The fear of God manifests itself by a carefulness not to offend God. Such who fear God are not only on their guard to avoid sin and give no offense to it, but they are in opposition to it. They strive against sin, acting the part of an antagonist, take to themselves the whole armor of God, and make use of it." It's what Stonewall Jackson said, the black flag. It's a black flag to the violators of our homes and firesides. It's the black flag to any sin that would encroach when we don't fear God. And finally, we need to strive to have pure hearts toward God. I'm going to bleed over just a little bit because I want to read a quote from George Grant, and then I'm going to close with a word from David. You may be anywhere on the spectrum in these five existential threats that I've talked about, but I want to read what Dr. Grant said. He said, "If you are faithful in every arena, in every battle, the dragon battles that we talk about, except precisely that one where the battle rages fiercest, if you are faithful in every other area but that one, you are an unfaithful man." He says, it's the exceptions that will determine the rule of our spiritual lives. Those little secret sins we have tucked away. Do you have a secret sin, Grant writes? Everything in your life may be in order, but that sin will eat away and fundamentally alter all that you are and all that you do. It's that one little exception, that one secret sin, that one unfought battle that will be your undoing. And we need to take this seriously. And we need to fight in Austin and fight in Washington. We need to fight for orthodoxy in our local church. That's a major battle that needs to be fought. But we need to fight pride, lust, failure to disciple our children, discontentment. These are just simple, basic vices, right? But they're fundamental to our Christian walk. They're fundamental to our Christian walk. We need to keep our hearts with all diligence, to quote David, for out of it flow the issues of life. So I'm going to close with two statements from David. Psalm 139, "Search me, O God, know my heart, try me and know my thoughts, and see if there be any wicked thing in me, and lead me in the way everlasting." And Psalm 19, "And may this be our prayer, who can understand his errors?" Who can understand his errors, David writes. I don't even understand how bad I am. God give me wisdom to understand my sin. Cleanse me from secret faults. Keep back thy servant from presumptuous sins. Let them not have dominion over me. Then will I be upright and shall be innocent from the great transgression. Let the words of my mouth, yeah, that's important, but the meditations of my heart be acceptable in thy sight, O Lord, my strength and my redeemer. And may that be our cry as we go out and seek to stand fast in the battles before us in our day and in our families. May God add His blessing to the reading of the Word, and maybe go away changed from these principles.
If you would like more information about Forge Ministries, including information about our upcoming events, please visit us on the web at forgeministries.org.